From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Generally, journalists pay dearly for failing to disclose a conflict of interest. And the leading interest that always poses a conflict is money. So, $1.3 million poses a lot of conflict. That's how much Dr. Fred Goodwin, host of the now-defunct public radio show The Infinite Mind, has received in speaking fees from drug companies since the year 2000. That's a heap of change not to disclose.
The New York Times broke this story last week, but this is not the first time Dr. Goodwin's financial ties have been questioned. This past May, a piece in Slate took serious issue with one particular episode of the show.
Today on The Infinite Mind, Prozac Nation revisited. In the wake of some recent highly publicized acts of violence, and in the wake of an FDA warning about antidepressants and their link to so-called suicidality, a warning that may have backfired, we want to take a look at the science underlying the connection between antidepressants and out-of-control behavior. Is there one?
We'll hear from the answer to that question, whether there's a link between antidepressants and an increased risk of suicide, turned out to be no. Dr. Goodwin and his three guests agreed that the risks had been exaggerated, especially by the media. In fact, they said, the real danger lay in not prescribing antidepressants.
It's something that can be overblown, and physicians will sometimes hesitate to utilize these medications where they can be helpful to people.
That's Prozac Nation, revisited, coming up today on The Infinite Mind.
As it happened, all three guests had some financial entanglements with the pharmaceutical industry, and of course, so did Dr. Goodwin. One guest was even paid directly by a major PR company for drug manufacturers, and the listeners never knew.
It's not a fair fight for listeners.
David Folkenflik is NPR's media correspondent.
If you're listening to a host and to guests, all of whom are being compensated by the very drug manufacturers whose products they are discussing, if you don't know that, there's no way really to critically sift through what they're saying to say, I can trust that or not.
Meanwhile, Goodwin and his former executive producer Bill Lichtenstein irreconcilably differ on exactly who knew what when. Goodwin says Lichtenstein knew about the money, just not how much. And Goodwin's account is confirmed by another of the show's former producers. But Lichtenstein has maintained that Goodwin did not disclose his conflicts of interest. Now, obviously, Dr. Goodwin was a doctor before he was on the radio, and NPR's Folkenflik told us that Goodwin sees himself first and foremost as a medical professional, not a journalist.
He says, look, you know, it is useful for researchers to be well aware of what's happening in the field, in the corporate practice. It's useful for them to be able to give input back into the corporate side and for them to understand where the corporate folks are going. The only place that he feels they fell down was in perhaps not disclosing to listeners that he had had some ties and payments.
We should say that Folkenflik spoke to us as a media reporter and in no way as an NPR spokesman. NPR didn't even produce The Infinite Mind, nor distribute it the way it distributes this show, but did air it on its Sirius satellite network channel along with other public radio programming until this story broke last week. The NPR affiliation was overstated in the coverage, as was The Infinite Mind's audience, which seems to be nowhere near the million listeners cited in the Times.
If you go based on the most recent audience surveys from last spring that done by Arbitron, you'd find that it was on 91 stations and reached 137,000 people each week.
But despite the small audience, the story has made a big splash. In 2009, Senator Charles Grassley, ranking Republican on the Senate Commerce Committee, plans to reintroduce the Physicians Payment Sunshine Act, requiring drug makers to report to the Department of Health and Human Services how much money they've paid doctors. Those payments then would be posted online. Grassley has also led investigations into the undisclosed ties between drug makers and university faculty, and his findings forced Harvard, Stanford, and Emory University to look into their faculty's potential conflicts. In fact, Grassley is the reason the Times and everyone else learned of the precise amount, that hefty $1.3 million, that The Infinite Mind's Goodwin received from drug makers. When Grassley read about the case in Slate this past May, he wrote a letter to GlaxoSmithKline asking the company to disclose its payments to Goodwin, and Glaxo did. We asked Senator Grassley if the Infinite Mind's limited audience lessened his concern.
No, we have certain things that we have to do to protect the consumer. If there's potential conflicts of interest, it ought to come out whether one person might be misled or a million people misled.
I must say I was utterly jealous of your ability to write a letter to GlaxoSmithKline and immediately be informed of its payment records with respect to Dr. Goodwin. We mere mortals can't really get that kind of responsiveness from corporations. That's a handy tool to have, eh?
Well, it sure is, but don't forget, we spend a lot of taxpayers' money on Glaxo's products. They have a relationship through a lot of federal programs. They want to maintain that.
Senator, the pharmaceutical industry spends millions of dollars every year cultivating so-called opinion leaders to spread positive messages about various drugs. What makes this episode, I think, particularly horrifying is that they got onto public radio, which is supposed to be as free of conflict of interest as any medium out there. Is it the fact that the Infinite Mind has a connection to public radio that made it so compelling for you?
Not, I wouldn't say compelling more than any other possible conflict of interest, but I can say this, that with public radio, besides the reputation, public funds being involved, just adds a little extra concern on my part, but I don't want NPR to think that I hold them responsible, because you get back to what we're trying to do through some of my basic legislation. One of the bills we have would affect Dr. Goodwin in the sense that his outside income needs to be reported. With a lot of university researchers we've been working with, we found that, for instance, a researcher would report but incomplete. The university accepted it without question. And the National Institute of Health has a responsibility of making sure the university collects that information to be made public and let the public decide whether or not there's a conflict of interest.
Senator, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, too. Goodbye.
Senator Charles Grassley is a Republican senator from Iowa and ranking member of the Senate Finance Committee.
Of course, the public can decide if it's got the facts. But Gary Schweitzer, director of the University of Minnesota's Health Journalism Program, says facts are hard to come by when it comes to the influence of pharmaceutical money on reporting. He's spent years rating health news reporting and advocating for full disclosure, and he concedes that untangling the complex pharma ties of guests on a public radio show or experts quoted in a medical journal is a tall order. But Schweitzer says the least they can do is ask.
We should be asking about and disclosing what we know about conflict of interest in our sources as a regular part of our interviewing, reporting, researching, and writing. It has to be there on every story. Journal policies on disclosure of conflict of interest are all over the map. But even when it is there, even when it is listed, some journalists won't pick up on that disclosure, or they will minimize it. A case in point, you'll probably remember, I believe it was 2 weeks ago, this major study, we were told, in the New England Journal of Medicine on cholesterol, on the drugs called statins.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all kicked off by this new test called a CRP, or C-reactive protein test.
Let us just say that that research seemed to find that even healthy people with relatively low cholesterol would benefit from taking that drug to the tune of, I don't know, $1 billion of extra sales.
Well, exactly. Some journalists reported that the study was funded by the drug company AstraZeneca that made the drug that was studied. And some, fewer, reported that the principal investigator actually held a patent on that CRP test that kicked the whole process off.
But if experts like Dr. Goodwin want to keep their ties a secret, it's hard to know what they are, isn't it?
It can be hard, but we should be able to find out.
How?
On a website that I publish, a website that grades health news coverage across the country called healthnewsreview.org, we now have a list on our homepage of independent experts that now numbers more than 100 internationally, top people who have sworn to us that they have no financial conflict of interest with industry right now. And these people should be in your Rolodex anyway.
That list is based on self-reporting. How can you be sure that you've been told the truth?
It is an imperfect, but certainly a better practice than what apparently took place in this instance, where it wasn't clear that anyone asked. An article in the formerly the British Medical Journal, now called the BMJ, just this last week, talked about 5 or 6 different levels of industry influence on the dissemination of messages to the American public, largely through journalism, through awards programs that give journalists big cash prizes and send them on international travel, or on television programming that appears in doctors' waiting offices where a journalist appears, supposedly giving integrity to the message, but indeed it's a one-sided product message. There are endless issues in this arena of industry influence that I think is one of the biggest concerns that we face.
So if you were to rate the sins of health reporters, what do you think the top 5 would be?
Gullibility and naivete as number 1, a failure to discuss costs as number 2, as number 3, the failure to tell both how small might be the potential benefit and how large might be the potential harms. Number 4, to get independent sources. And number 5, to always be looking for conflict of interest in those sources.
Wow, I didn't expect you to be ready with 5 just like that. Gary, thank you very much.
Well, thanks for your continued interest in these really important issues.
Gary Schweitzer is the director of the University of Minnesota's Health Journalism Program and founder of healthnewsreview.org.
Coming up, term paper ethics and atheism.
Tis the season. This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Millions of college kids have traveled home for Thanksgiving this weekend, but before they left school, there were midterms to take and papers to write. Some students pulled all-nighters, studying the texts, reviewing notes, searching for primary and secondary sources, and churning out pages. Others put Google on overdrive, cutting, pasting, and stitching together a patchwork of other people's ideas. For still others, online plagiarism was simply too laborious, so they pulled out their credit cards and bought their term papers from people like our guest. Writer Nick Mamatis spent several years doing other people's assignments for them, an experience he wrote about last month for the Drexel University online magazine, The Smart Set. Nick, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Okay, let's start with some terminology. You refer in your piece to, quote, model term papers, as if anyone actually used your work simply as a template or a how-to. Do you know of any instance in which your work wasn't handed in under your customer's name?
Oh, sure. For a lot of these clients, handing in something that isn't any good would be so obviously not their own work that they do try to rewrite it.
They take what you've sent and worsen it.
That's right. They put in their own words, their own horrible, horrible words.
All right. Now, I'm wondering about the mechanics of the business. You're willing to sell yourself for money. How do you get your clients?
Well, I worked through brokers. I was a freelancer, and these brokers would handle most of the dealing with the clients because the clients are sort of they're so dumb that most of them don't even understand their assignments. So the broker is there to talk with them over the phone for sometimes hours trying to get what the actual assignment is. The brokers take the financial risk of using like the credit card and deal with the customer service and whatnot. So they collect 2/3 of the money or so from that.
Got it. Now, you wrote that the clientele fell into 3 main categories. Can you give me the thumbnails?
Sure. Well, the first category, as we've already hinted at, was the dumb client. And one of my brokers would even have dumb client in the email describing that so I would know not to make the paper too good. The second are sort of the one-timers, people who have one bad class or who got sick and out of an act of desperation, you know, buy a single paper. And the third were people who just weren't very good with English. And they had advanced degrees in their home countries, but they didn't qualify here, so they had to go to school again. And for the most part, they would just write their own papers, and we would rewrite those in proper English.
The biggest part of the business was the so-called dumb clients?
Oh, yes, definitely more than half.
And how did your customers do? Did you find out what grades you got for them?
Oh, sure. Both when they were thrilled, they'd, you know, say, oh, we want you to do the second paper because the first one went so great first. And, of course, when they failed miserably, you know, we also heard about that a lot, too.
You mean you got paid to write papers and the people flunked?
Oh, sure. They flunked for several reasons. People hand them in, and obviously they don't even realize that it's obviously not their work.
Let me just quote from you here. Quote, writing model term papers is above board and perfectly legal. Thanks to the First Amendment, it's protected speech, right up there with neo-Nazi rallies, tobacco company press releases, and those 9/11 was an inside job bumper stickers. So, I mean, I don't want to be putting words in your mouth, but I think what you're saying is legal but repulsive, sleazy,
oh, sure,
unethical, morally disgraceful. Am I leaving anything out?
No, that's pretty much sums it up, yeah.
So, Nick, how do you rationalize your behavior? I mean, it sounds kind of whorish to me.
Well, again, I also think that prostitution should be legal. I've written several term papers about that over the years. As far as my own working term papers, basically, I felt my other writing was more important. You know, everyone makes these decisions. What about people who work in munitions factories or who work for defense contractors? So we all make these decisions. It's just a cost-benefit analysis. In the end, I thought I benefited from writing these papers because it allowed me to work at home and write novels and short stories and articles. And the people who were buying the papers, well, that was their decision. They could take that as a model paper, and many of them did. They could hand it in and roll the dice, because I was always happy, always thrilled, actually, to hand in a paper to a professor if the client, you know, was trying to pull one over on me or was even nasty to me sometimes. I just sort of like secretly fax it.
Wait. What did you do? You submarined your own client for cheating?
Sometimes, yes, if they were nasty to me. You have to sign a document saying, I will use this paper only for research purposes, et cetera, when you buy one of these papers. So if they broke that rule, all I'm doing by sending the professor the same papers is giving him a heads up.
Wow. Now you're scaring me. I hear your rationalization. Of course, mind you, I don't buy it. But now that this is all behind you, is there nothing about your personal conduct that torments you as an enabler for cheaters?
No, because I think a lot of those cheaters ended up getting their own in the end. You know, they ended up, karma tends to work out in my favor, or in the favor of people who don't cheat.
I don't predict the future much, but I'm going to predict it this time. We're going to run this conversation, and the online comments will go as follows. 90% are going to say, what's the matter with this guy? I felt dirty just listening to him trying to rationalize his own unsavory behavior. Is there anything you want to say to those people kind of in advance, maybe to preemptively address their concerns?
After the essay came out in the smartset.com last month, I got a lot of email from people. And some of them were professors saying, how can I, you know, see if I have cheating students? I said, well, quiz them on their papers afterward. Just, you know, talk to them informally about the content of their papers. And I got about a dozen or so emails from people, some of them who have PhDs, some of them who are graduate students, and some of them who are just independent writers or whatnot, saying, can you introduce me to your old broker?
Oh, my God. Oh, Nick, thank you very much for coming onto the show and taking this drubbing.
No problem.
Nick Mamatis is the author of two novels, his piece, The Term Paper Artist, about his experience as a paper writer for hire, appeared last month in The Smart Set, a journal published online by Drexel University. The Wall Street Journal reported recently about some new tactics atheists are using to win your hearts and minds. The American Humanist Association, Free Thought Action, and other groups have purchased ads over the past year on city buses and public highways beseeching you to, quote, beware of dogma. The Madison, Wisconsin-based Freedom from Religion Foundation erected a billboard in Cucamonga, California this month with the John Lennon-inspired phrase, imagine no religion. It lasted only a few days until community complaints compelled the billboard company to take it down. In response, Freedom from Religion Foundation co-president Annie Laurie Gaylor marveled at all the sensitivity of the complainers. Quote, one small free thought billboard in the immense state of California is such a threat to insecure religious egos that it must be censored. But as Brooke reported 2 years ago, the brash new atheists, as they're called, don't really care. No longer content to silently disavow religion, they are on the offensive and are taking no prisoners.
Atheism already had a PR problem. Then came Sam Harris, author of Letter to a Christian Nation. When he wrote that since 20% of all recognized pregnancies end in miscarriage, God is, quote, the most prolific abortionist of all, he really made people mad. Harris is one of the most vocal spokesmen for the so-called new atheists, along with Oxford scientist Richard Dawkins, author of The God Delusion. They wield logic like a bludgeon, so much so that even Comedy Central's South Park, a series that has savaged Scientology, Christian fundamentalism, and the Mormons, got out the knives.
Let us not forget the great Richard Dawkins, who finally freed the world of religion long ago. Dawkins knew that logic and reason were the way of the future. But it wasn't until he met his beautiful wife that he learned using logic and reason isn't enough. You have to be a dick to everyone who doesn't think like you.
Sam Harris concedes he's on a mission to make moderates less moderate.
Because moderates insist that we respect their religious faith, we can't criticize the role that religious faith is playing in dividing people.
And Harris says moderates are mistaken if they believe the wall between church and state can protect us from extremists. They've already scaled it.
If you think the creator of the universe is letting people fly planes into our buildings because we are tolerating gay marriage, or he's whipping up hurricanes in the Gulf because we're tolerating gay marriage, you have to try to legislate against gay marriage. And if you think the creator of the universe is going to be scandalized by the mere depiction of Muhammad, you have to take to the streets and start rioting. There's nothing intolerant or mean or fundamentalist or dogmatic about opposing this kind of delusion.
Real life differs from culture wars in the media.
Gary Wolf wrote about the new atheists in Wired magazine. He says that the blunt tactics used by the new atheists cannot be applied to personal arguments over faith, where delicate family and work relationships might hang in the balance. He says the polemics of new atheism can be just as nasty as the fundamentalists.
So while I don't accuse the atheists of being fundamentalists, the rhetoric they use resonates with the religious rhetoric that controls much of our cultural debate today.
Sam Harris.
There's nothing fundamentalist about rejecting the claim that the universe is 6,000 years old.
Yes, there is, says Christian Coalition founder Pat Robertson, speaking on the 700 Club.
What we've got to recognize just there in this case is that the evolutionists worship atheism. I mean, that's their religion. So this is an establishment of religion contrary to the First Amendment of the United States Constitution.
If, in fact, atheism were a religion, it might get more respect.
That label evokes a strong negative response in American life.
Penny Edgell is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Minnesota. In 2003, she and her colleagues, Doug Hartman and Joe Gratice, conducted a national poll to determine which of 10 ethnic and religious groups the average American would least like their children to marry.
We had included atheists on the list as a group that we expected would have low levels of disapproval. And therefore, we thought, well, that will be a good yardstick against which to measure other kinds of attitudes. We were really very surprised.
Atheists were deemed the least desirable. Muslims did better in 2003, and gays and lesbians, maybe because most respondents had at least seen one or two. But research suggests avowed atheists are few and far between.
Just do the numbers, right? If they're only 7% of the American population, odds are most people don't know one.
People fear what they don't know, and so they tend to be suspicious of the absence of a presence in the lives of atheists.
It is religion, having a faith, that makes people in the American context seem trustworthy, like good citizens and good neighbors. So if you don't have that as a moral boundary, you're an outsider, an other, and perhaps a dangerous other.
We're all familiar with phrases like, you know, I have to say it, Jews are cheap, Italians are in the mafia, blacks are on welfare, gays are promiscuous, and atheists are immoral.
Ellen Johnson is the president of American Atheists, but the phrase she hates most of all goes a little something like this.
Perhaps you've heard the expression, there are no atheists in foxholes.
Wartime, there are no atheists in foxholes.
To amend the old saying about foxholes, there are no atheists driving trucks in Iraq.
That was CBS's Katie Couric and Bob Schieffer and NPR's John Burnett. Those are just the three we got tape of. News people say it all the time. Ellen Johnson.
It's demeaning to atheists. It's saying that under very dire circumstances or frightening situations, atheists will stop being atheists. They will start to believing. And this is really just a wish on the part of the religious because it's not based in fact.
I thought it was a good line for the tape.
NPR's John Burnett.
And I didn't realize that it was so offensive to atheists. And I learned that in spades after the story came out. They spammed me for weeks with email saying, we're outraged. So now I know.
And did you sort of see their point?
I do see their point. I literally hadn't thought about it before. And frankly, I will think twice about using the phrase again.
So if the news media aren't sensitive to atheists, Hollywood must be, right? I mean, the political right says it's so gay and liberal and irreligious.
Faith. That's another word for ignorance, isn't it?
That's Dr. Gregory House, a brilliant if antisocial diagnostician and the main character in the Fox medical drama, House. He's also an atheist. In a recent episode, House comes up against a teenaged faith healer who seems to be curing a patient with terminal cancer.
I fear for the human race. A teenager claims to be the voice of God, and people with advanced degrees are listening.
In a hospital staff lounge, a colleague posts a scoreboard with two columns, House versus God. Whenever House can't explain a medical result, says David Shore, creator of the series,
God got a check mark. When House explains something, House got a check mark.
At the end of the show, on that little tally board, you left it at a draw.
Yes.
But I think you were actually pulling your punches a little there, weren't you?
I hope not. Maybe. I do it sometimes. I don't know.
Yes, he does, because House actually found a medical explanation for everything the faith healer claimed to be doing through God. Hollywood usually pulls its punches on atheism. Mostly, TV atheists are lost souls, like Jen in the teenage drama Dawson's Creek that ran from 1998 to 2003. Here was Jen in the series premiere.
You know, I don't do real well with church and the Bible and this prayer stuff.
I beg your pardon?
I don't covet a religious God. Grams, I'm an atheist.
And here she is in the series finale, terminally ill, taping a farewell message to her baby daughter.
I've never really believed in God, but I hope that you are able to believe in God. Because the thing that I've come to realize, sweetheart, is that it just doesn't matter if God exists or not. The important thing is for you to believe in something.
There's very few openly atheistic people on television, and I find that a little surprising.
House creator and writer David Shore.
Atheists to me fall in the same category to some extent as lawyers, in the sense that people hate them in general, but like their own. They know House, they like House. They don't care he's an atheist, I don't think.
You know, I get it. People are just looking for a way to fill the holes, but they want the holes. They want to live in the holes. And they go nuts when someone else pours dirt in their holes. Climb out of your holes, people!
I like that one. I like that one a lot.
But even Shore is inclined to believe there are no atheists in foxholes, or at least hospitals.
To ignore issues of faith is to ignore a pretty fundamental part of all people's lives when they're in the hospital facing death. I'm not saying all people find God, but they certainly do ask those questions.
What's an atheist to do? American Atheist President Ellen Johnson says they have to organize.
Until the atheists start voting their atheism and be identified as a voting bloc in America, the politicians aren't going to listen to us. We're not going to have any influence in the public schools. We're not going to have any influence in the media or anywhere else.
But even she concedes that organizing atheists is like herding cats. Sam Harris says the only way to win is to keep up the pressure until religious tolerance is no longer tolerated.
I think the criticism of irrationality just has to come from 100 sides all at once in the entertainment community. I mean, you'll just have people making jokes that are funny enough and true enough so as to put religious certainty in a bad light.
We know atheists are brave.
Comedy Central's Stephen Colbert.
They're not afraid to go to hell and be tortured by Satan for all eternity, which is what's going to happen.
one day someone in the White House press corps will hear the President of the United States express some certainty about being in dialogue with the creator of the universe, and he or she will ask a question which should be on everybody's mind. How is this any different from thinking you're in dialogue with Zeus?
That day is far off. But Harris has a great deal of faith in his fellow man.
I'm hopeful that journalists and people in the entertainment industry are waiting for the permission to express their doubts. And I think that permission is coming. I mean, I'm trying to do what I can to engineer it in my hard-headed and boorish way. And I feel, just from the contacts I have in both industries, that there's a profound sense of relief that comes with hearing somebody call a spade a spade.
Was that what Stephen Colbert was doing when he addressed an audience of Hollywood elite at the Emmys this year?
Good evening, godless sodomites.
Harris may have no tolerance for the gospel, but as an atheist trying to enlist Hollywood in his crusade, Colbert's greeting has to sound like some kind of good news.
Coming up, photojournalists, ready or not, it's time for your close-up.
Say cheese. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, where arts and education leaders can learn about how to bring the arts to more people. Downloads at the Knowledge Center at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Every now and then, photojournalism gives rise to ethical questions. For instance, why was O.J.'s image digitally darkened on the cover of Time? Did tight shots of Saddam's statue being toppled by Iraqis intentionally obscure the U.S. Marines' role in the incident? Did newspapers whitewash the horror of war by suppressing images of corpses? Were famous photos from World War I and the Spanish Civil War actually reenactments? There are clear rules that supposedly govern such situations, sometimes observed, sometimes not. But as Bob reports, one category of mass media photography operates with hardly any rules at all. By the way, go to onthemedia.org to find a slideshow of the photos discussed in this piece.
Jill Greenberg is a portrait photographer most famous for a series of pictures of toddlers crying their eyes out. She achieved these hilarious and heartbreaking Kodak moments by giving the kids lollipops, then grabbing the treats away. Okay, maybe it's a little bit on the cruel side. On the other hand, the kids get over it in about a minute, and the pictures are fabulous. So suck on that one a while. Meantime, know that Greenberg photographs grown-ups, too. Famous ones, on assignment for such publications as Wired, Entertainment Weekly, TV Guide, and all three major news magazines. In September, she was asked by The Atlantic to do a cover portrait of John McCain. Now, it happens that Greenberg despises McCain. So, after capturing the heroic poses Atlantic editors were seeking, she coaxed the presidential candidate toward a separate lighting setup, where she posed him above a strobe. This gave her the shot she was looking for, one she posted on her website, a diabolical McCain awash in ghastly facial shadows. Later, Greenberg bragged to the New York Post how easy it had been to trick him, like taking candy from a baby, you might say. Yet she doesn't quite get why her Atlantic editors and many others flipped out.
I do the job that's asked of me that day. And what I do beyond that is not really anyone's business. You know, especially when this election was so crucial to me and my family, I just felt, you know, maybe coloring outside the lines this one time wouldn't be such a big deal.
Assuming she can locate any line in the first place, the McCain episode was merely the latest to raise ethics questions in portrait photography, chief among them being, are there any? Where is the distinction between artistic prerogative and photo gotcha? If a picture is worth 1,000 words, who protects the subject and the audience from 1,000 words manipulated or taken out of context? The answers reside in the murk of art, journalistic comment, reader expectations, and even basic human vanity. But the topic here is potentially corrupting influences, so let's begin with the most obvious, the profit motive. The cover of a magazine is the single biggest determinant of sales.
It's very much an advertisement for the publication.
Mary Ann Golan is former director of photography for Time magazine.
Once you're choosing an image, you want the image to be arresting. You want it to stand out in all the media noise on a newsstand.
Obviously, newsstand appeal hinges mainly on the subject, him or herself. But that quick newsstand scan is critical. Hence the demand for such distinctive portraitists as Greenberg, Platon, Martin Scholler, Annie Leibovitz, and the late Richard Avedon.
I think there has been a long tradition in portrait photography where photographers try to capture a person's personality rather than feeling obliged in trying to make them look good.
Photographer Martin Scholler.
The best example, I think, is Richard Avedon. I mean, you feel like he would take your picture and you would come across as mentally challenged. I don't think Avedon ever tried to please anyone but himself with his portraits.
Nor Scholler himself. His ultra-tight portraits, which have appeared in such publications as Rolling Stone and The New Yorker, are typically grim mug shots, sort of Chuck Close meets your driver's license photo. His Jack Nicholson could be a serial rapist, and his Barack Obama resembles Abraham Lincoln, homely wart and all. The shots are arty and arresting, but not exactly flattering, although Scholler takes issue with that characterization.
I don't think my pictures are unflattering, to be honest. The light is very flattering. It's not a wide-angle lens. They're not distorted. I just think that people are nowadays not used to seeing people as people anymore, and your perception of the environment is so twisted by all these pictures that you see in magazines and advertisements that if you see a person just for who they are, you're already shocked.
Are we indeed so conditioned to the unreal world of ads and celebrity photography that we, the audience, can't handle the truth? Certainly magazine photography, at least where movie stars aren't involved, is not hagiography. It is not commissioned to flatter the subject. But whether you're JFK sitting for Karsh of Ottawa or the family next door posing in sweaters at Olin Mills, no one wants to look mentally challenged or criminal or demonic or even unattractive. So do portraitists and editors have any responsibility to their subject's basic vanity? Reporters certainly don't. If the reporting doesn't distort facts or context, nobody has a beef. Why should photography be held to a different standard?
All I can do is to try and find a human quality.
This is the photographer Platon.
And break through all these plastic walls that are put up in front of me and my sitter, and all the time restrictions and all the pressure that they try to bombard me with to stop me finding perhaps my sense of what the truth is.
Platon shot the famous Esquire photo of Bill Clinton, cat who ate the canary, grin on his face, hands on his knees, and necktie like the arrow of Eros, pointing to his notorious crotch. Platon has also famously crafted portraits of a menacing Barry Bonds, Karl Rove cowled in a sinister black aura, and a sepulchral Vladimir Putin. Platon believes it is loathsome to use digital or darkroom tricks to distort somebody's likeness, but he's cool with whatever actually happens at the shoot, such as his April 2005 Ann Coulter photo on the cover of Time magazine. The incendiary right-wing author was shot from almost floor level with a wide-angle lens, filling the foreground with her optically elongated legs. I can tell you, this is the one and only time I personally felt sympathy for Ann Coulter. She looked like a blonde praying mantis. Platon.
She's very tall, very, very slim, very skinny, and she's got these massive long legs. I mean, sure, there is a distortion, perhaps, of perspective, but this is really how I see her. I was probably a few inches away from her toes when I was taking the picture. So for her to be slightly smiling at me and leaning forward, she knows what's going on.
But did she know the effect of the wide lens?
Well, I mean, look, everybody now in the business seems to know the way I see the world. I want to pull people out of their reality and into our reality.
Out of her reality, how he sees her, what his truth is. Is that a confession or a mission statement? Time's Mary Ann Golan was on the set that day, and she thinks the latter. The crux of the matter, she believes, is artistic interpretation.
I mean, if someone is a public figure and you subject them to any sort of representation, it could be a political cartoon, it could be an artist illustration, it could be a photographer, there's going to be an interpretation of that person.
And for the very reason that people are vain and self-conscious, trying to define their own interpretation of themselves for the lens, they sometimes need to be nudged or prodded or even manipulated into revealing something of themselves, such as when Yousef Karsh pulled the cigar from Winston Churchill's mouth, like candy from a baby, and triggered portraiture's most famous scowl.
And should the photographer not have done that? I'd say no, of course. The photographer should have yanked the cigar out of his mouth because it was a fantastic, reflective, important portrait of an important person at an important time. And I would pretty much hold the same for Ann Coulter and the image Platon did.
Fair enough, although let the record reflect that after Platon pulled Coulter from her reality to his, Golan got a call from her own mother who thought Coulter looked like a spider. In photography, this reality thing is hard to pin down. Each of a sitting's dozens or hundreds of shots is a frozen two-dimensional representation of a living, moving, three-dimensional being, a laser-sliced instant invisible in real time. It may be a reasonable likeness. It may express some aspect of mood or personality, but it is, by definition, out of context, altered by angle, lighting, and optics. Platon.
It's such a strange artistic process that it's very difficult to express in words. I mean, you could say that I'm a disturber, or I'm a professional outsider, and I come in and try to disturb the status quo.
In purely artistic terms, such sentiments are unassailable. But if a magazine writer marched into a profile interview with the announced intention of cajoling from a subject a single word or phrase that would be the sole focus of the profile, well, that's pretty much the definition of gotcha journalism. Is creating a disturbance ever a reasonable journalistic technique?
To be quite honest, I'm often surprised that I'm allowed to carry on doing what I do every day, but I haven't been stopped yet, and I'm still waiting to be sent out of the country for bad photographic behavior.
Not likely. Platon is prized by editors for the same reason he is shocking to readers. He plays havoc with our expectations. Expectations so obsessively reinforced by Hollywood and Madison Avenue that we've all been, in Platon's words, sedated with perfection. You may recall Scholler saying much the same. In magazine photography circles, this is a steady refrain. Here's Meir Roshan, founder and editor-in-chief of the recently defunct Radar magazine.
You look at any Hollywood celebrity, half of your time is spent wrangling over what they will wear. Some of them demand final photo approval. They demand certain photographers. Hollywood celebrities have a lot of power over how they're depicted in magazine covers.
A New York Times piece last weekend described, for instance, Angelina Jolie's demands, not only for photo approval from People magazine, but also promises about reportage in exchange for baby pictures. For self-respecting photographers and editors, that stuff is frustrating and humiliating. And one after another, they describe the impulse to assert independence. It comes up so often, you have to wonder, when a subject without the leverage to call the shots gets stung, is that entirely independence or also backlash? Consider Radar's September cover piece titled, What's So Scary About Michelle Obama? Plucked to illustrate it from the rolls and rolls of shots of a smiling future first lady was one moment when she stared blankly at the camera, her arms folded across her chest. The angry black woman herself. Now, the story was precisely about confronting that stereotype, so the cover photo could be justified on pertinence alone. But Obama felt hoodwinked, a fate Angelina Jolie need not fear. Is that fair? Well, maybe it is. One argument goes that a photo subject, by agreeing to the shoot, assumes all risks. Jill Greenberg.
You know, maybe Ann Coulter doesn't have a publicist from a great agency that is good at protecting her. But when somebody signs up for a cover photo shoot, they're doing it for their own best interest. They're doing it for their own PR. And, you know, you have to be careful. You don't know what the story is going to be. I mean,
caveat emptor.
Exactly. It's a gamble.
Wow. Media roulette. You pays your money and you takes your chances. Moreover, Greenberg says, the wheel is sometimes rigged.
I've been assigned by magazine editors to make people look bad. You know, I've been assigned to trick my subject by magazine editors. It's just really strange. I mean, people just don't actually know the way things are.
Greenberg declined to provide details or to name names, so let's just hope premeditated photo hatchet jobs are rare. But if they aren't, how could we be surprised? When it comes to ethics or canons of conduct, the lines, if they even exist, are maddeningly out of focus.
I went to art school, so I don't know what those canons and ethics are.
Nor is she by any means alone. I asked Martin Scholler, is there a standard of basic fairness, for example?
I think this varies greatly from photographer to photographer. is the answer.
No, Scholler hasn't gotten the memo. Greenberg hasn't gotten the memo because the memo has yet to be written. High time, I'd say. Not because these issues are black and white, but because they obviously aren't.
When we relaunched On the Media almost 9 years ago, we had a big decision to make. Is the word media singular or plural? Do we say, for example, the media is out to get us or the media are out to get us? We chose are. Grammatically, it's a no-brainer. Media, like data, are plural. The singular of data is datum. The singular of media is medium, which could refer to a specific communications platform like print or TV or papier-mâché or a person who communicates with the dead. But when we say media are, we're also taking a position that the media are composed of many voices and is not a monolith that critics charge speaks for the power elite. Jeff Jarvis, who blogs at buzzmachine.com, generally shares our view but has reached the opposite conclusion. He's on the line. Welcome back.
Thank you.
So you're in the is camp. I guess I should have known you being all contrarian and anti-Latinate endings and all like that.
I think media have gone from plural to singular. When I started in journalism, you had to pick one medium for life. Now, still photographers can now do video on their still cameras. Print reporters are doing video as part of their stories. TV reporters are doing video and text and graphics and everything else. So it all becomes one. And if there's no distinctions among all these formerly separate media, then I think media must become singular.
Oh, I see. So you're looking at the media in terms of the platforms all merging, ultimately everything coming out of a single box, which is something that I believe too. But what about media as a cultural institution? Once the media is referred to as an is, then people think they can ascribe a single personality to it.
Well, that was truer when it was an oligopoly. Now the media have exploded so that we all can participate in it. We all can create. We are making videos by the bazillions. We are making audio. We're writing. We're doing all this stuff. You know, here's the problem, Brooke. We in media are so egotistical. We look at this internet coming along and see it in our own image. Oh, that's media, and everyone there who's doing stuff wants to be like us. They're often not. They're often just conversing. And that conversation itself becomes media.
No, I get that. I totally get that, despite my egotism. But the fact of the matter is a lot of people who advocate for media is are coming to that decision from the exact opposite direction. They're the ones who say that it is a tacit acknowledgement that media is being concentrated in fewer and fewer hands, and therefore does, in fact, speak with a single voice.
I think the concentration problem is over, thanks to the internet. In fact, the only concentration that's going on is dinosaurs huddling together against the cold wind of the future. So you have companies like Tribune Company that brought all this media in together into one big conglomerate, and look at the trouble they're in. I don't think we have this problem of the monolithic media. That day is over. We are all part of the media now. We all own it now.
And so, like the American people, we refer to it in the singular.
Media is.
Jeff, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brooke.
So what do you say, Bob? Should we stick with media are or move into the brave new world of media is?
Well, Jeff makes an interesting point.
are.
Yeah, me too.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, and Michael Bernstein, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. We also had help from Dina Prechep and Andy Lancet. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.